My name is Denny Freeman. I was born August 7th, 1944. My parents are Ed and Rachel Freeman. I was born on an Army Air Corps base outside of Orlando, Florida, where my dad was stationed. My mother joined him there while she was pregnant, so I was born there. Otherwise, I would have been born in Hillsboro, Texas, because that's where they had moved and were living when he joined the Army. I lived in Hillsboro till I was 8, and then I moved to Dallas through high school. Hillsboro, Texas affected me very much. It's a small town about 30 miles north of Waco on I-35. And my parents were just middle-class people. My dad owned a paint and body and upholstery shop. And we're just a typical small-town middle-class family. My parents grew up 30 miles north of Hillsboro in Waxahachie, Texas. So I just grew up in old-school, small-town, North Texas, middle-class values. So Hillsboro, I just had a normal childhood, nothing traumatic, nothing particularly memorable, stable home, just all the usual stuff. Parents had a lot of friends, I had a lot of friends, nothing really memorable, just a normal middle class thing. I think I was really lucky that way. And then we moved to Dallas in 1952. Right when I turned 8 years old, and we moved into Oak Cliff in South Dallas there, and lived there for about a year and a half, and then moved out to the new suburbs out in northeast Dallas, and that's where I lived until I got out of high school. And Dallas influenced me a lot, but not maybe until like junior high school. Because my whole youth was influenced by the middle, just the middle class values, kind of straight conservative parents, but stable. Everything was just fine and normal. No trauma, no drama. So I was really lucky that way. Kind of strict, but that was okay. I realized later, but the way that Dallas, I was influenced by Dallas was. So I'm old enough to, when I was a child, I never gave any thought to music, really. Because when I was a child, there was no rock and roll. And I wasn't really, my parents weren't musical, and I wasn't really drawn to any kind of music. But like in 1955, when I was like 11, around 11, 12, that's when what they had started calling rock and roll was making its way onto the airwaves for white radio. And I've told this story so many times, but just as I was becoming an adolescent, that's when all of a sudden, out of nowhere, was Elvis and Buddy Holly and Gene Vincent and Fats Domino and Little Richard, and all of the people that invented rock and roll. Just it seems like just all of, there was none, and all of a sudden there was many, and I was the perfect age to get my little mind blown by that. But most people around the U.S. were getting that kind of exposure on the airwaves, because Chuck Berry and Fats Domino, Little Richard, Elvis, Buddy Holly and the Crickets, all of those people, they were on the charts. You could see them on the Ed Sullivan Show, and they were on the radio. But in Dallas, after I got into that, Dallas, it wasn't just Dallas, but not every place was a gateway to blues. And so that other music was a gateway to blues, because the early rock and roll was it was first cousins to hillbilly music and blues and stuff like that. And I didn't care anything about country music at the time. But once my mind got blown and open to music and this new rock and roll stuff, blues was just right around the corner in Dallas. And so I discovered all of the important, well, not all the important blues, but I discovered like Chess Records and all of the whatever blues was available to me in the late 50s. Well, probably by 57, I was checking out blues, and blues was in my part of town. A lot of people won't know who these artists are, but they were real important. Jimmy Reed and Lightnin' Hopkins, John Lee Hooker, Bo Diddley, Muddy Waters, Little Walter, all of those people I got turned on to in high school and junior high. And there was a radio station in Dallas. It was actually a city-owned radio station called WRR. And in the daytime, this was not a top 40 station. In the daytime, this station was adult-oriented big band music in the daytime. But at night, there was a show called Cat's Caravan that came on. And the DJ, Jim Lowe, who was the voice of Big Tex at the State Fair of Texas, if anybody remembers Big Tex, had a show called Cat's Caravan. And that same station that played all this mostly white big band stuff in the daytime played the great blues at night. And so it's kind of funny to think about 13 and 14 year olds getting into blues these days, because most 13 year olds don't even know what it is, and if they heard it they wouldn't like it, but there was a time when that's what appealed to us, and it certainly appealed to me. And having access to that kind of music is what probably shaped my musical thing more than anything else. I came to Austin the first time, I think it was late 1969, with some friends of mine. I'd never been here. I was like 25 at the time, and I'd never been to Austin. And some friends of mine had been coming down here. I had known people that went to UT, and by 1969, some musicians that I knew had started to come down here and play, and they knew some people. And one weekend, some friends of mine said, "Hey, let's go to Austin." And I'd never been, so I said, "Yeah, sure." So I came down here, and the very first day that I came, it seems like it might have been fall. Seems like it was kind of a gray, cold day, and I think we even came down here in a Volkswagen. I wasn't a hippie, but we looked like hippies to cops and rednecks. We definitely were of the subculture, if not counterculture, but we weren't like hippies. We were like musicians, which was kind of different. But anyway, so we come down here, and the very first day that I was here, I'd been here about an hour and realized I need to be here. I could, just the people that I knew and the people that they knew, and I think we might have even driven straight to the Vulcan Gas Company. It was in the afternoon, but it was closed, but we knew people and there were people there, and I think I might have even met Jim Franklin the day we pulled into town. There's a cistern. There was a cistern in the back of the club, and you could climb down this ladder and sit in the cistern and smoke something if you had it, you know. And I was just going, "Whoa, this is crazy!" And then that was a historic club, the Vulcan Gas Company. That's where we went, and I was standing out in front of it, and I was looking. There's the Capitol, you know, and I'm thinking, here I am in downtown Austin at this crazy place, and there's just beautiful girls everywhere, it seemed like, and it was just such a lovely, the town. I mean, I was right, but I had my assessment of it happened pretty fast. I just thought, this is a lovely, beautiful town. It's rustic, it's got nice old houses and trees, and just a small college town, and it was just beautiful, but it was just long-haired people everywhere, and I had there was a lot of places in those days that if you had long hair, it was kind of dangerous. And Dallas was not exactly welcoming to people with long hair. As a matter of fact, I'd already left and gone to California. And I only came down here because I was on a visit from California. I'd returned from my sister's wedding and stuck around town. And then that's when I came to Austin. In other words, I had already moved to California before I'd even come to Austin. It's just 200 miles away. And but that first visit, I decided that I wasn't going to go back to California because it looked like everything that I was looking for out there, I could probably find in Austin. I just made that assessment the first day or two that I was here. And at the time, it proved right. It took me almost a year to actually move down here because I had a lot of complications in my life. But I just came down here with some friends. And in a day or two, I said, man, I really like it here. And so I came down. I moved here in May of 1970. I started playing guitar. You'd think I would know exactly, but I think it had to have been when I was in maybe the summer in between the 8th and 9th grade, maybe. Maybe I was 14 or something, maybe just about the time I turned 14. A friend of mine and I there was a teen dance that they had in our part of town every Friday night. And my friend and I would spend the night with my friend, and we would walk up to the place. The older kids would drive their Mercs and their Fords and everything, but we would walk up there and in this little teen room about the size of this room. Every Friday they would have music, and it was called Teen Timers. And at the time that we started going, one Friday somebody would just spin 45s, just play records, and the next week they would have a band. And me and my friend would just sit there and watch the kids dance and listen to the music and listen to the bands and stuff. And one night there was a band there called the Don Hosick Combo. It was just a guy playing guitar and a guy playing piano and a drummer. And the guitar player was a real handsome guy, had sideburns. He looked kind of like Elvis, but he was standing there playing a Fender Stratocaster. He wasn't singing. He was just standing there real cool, looked real handsome and cool and everything, but he was just standing there playing an electric guitar. I didn't know what a Fender Stratocaster was at the time, but me and my friend just looked at each other and said, we got to learn how to do that. And so we started taking lessons, and I think that was probably, because I remember that I don't remember playing music in the eighth grade, but I remember playing music with my, and just starting to play music in the ninth grade. And my mother, so we took these lessons for a while. We quit eventually because it was taking our instructor a little bit too long to get around to the Jimmy Reed and Chuck Berry, so we thought maybe we could do better on our own, so we quit. But when we took the lessons, they provided an acoustic guitar, because the whole deal was, it was called the Trick Brothers School of Accordion and Guitar. And the deal was, I mean, they taught us how to, they got us started playing, but I think the main thing was that, you know, what they wanted to do was sell our parents their overpriced guitars and amplifiers, you know. And so anyway, but my friend and I quit because they were taking a little bit too long to get around to the rock and roll. So we were on our own then, and I couldn't believe it, but my mother, she knew I wanted to play, and she wasn't really against it or anything, and we didn't really have that much money, but I can't remember how it happened, but I remember that we went to downtown Dallas on Elm Street, the area that used to be called Deep Ellum, and now it's called Deep Ellum now. It's where all the clubs are downtown, but back then at this time they just had pawn shops and old machine shops. It looked a whole lot like Sixth Street before all the nightclubs and stuff. It was a similar part of town to Dallas, but maybe with more pawn shops. Anyway, we went in there, and I don't know if I can't remember if I'd already located this guitar and said, "Mother, mother, please." Or maybe I'd spotted it on my own, but we went in there and I walked out with a Fender Stratocaster from this pawn shop, and I still almost tear up thinking about it, because that was like I was 14, but for a 14-year-old kid to have a Fender Stratocaster, that was the coolest three-dimensional object in my world. It was like getting a 59 Cadillac convertible or something. I mean, I got home and I was looking at, I have a Fender Stratocaster. There's some knobs missing, there it's starting to rust. But I had a Fender Stratocaster, I couldn't believe it. And so my girlfriend she became my girlfriend. These girls had a singing group called the Teen Tones, and me and my buddy backed them up. They wanted to be in talent shows, and we could barely play, but we could figure out the music to the songs that they wanted to sing, because back in those days, most of the rock and roll was just three or four chord songs, and it was so similar that even beginners like us with a little work could figure out the music. So anyway, I started playing when I was in the ninth grade, and then formed our first band with some other folks in between the ninth and 10th grade. So the first real band I was in, I was in the 10th grade. When I moved down here, we mainly came down to play blues. In the 60s, we were checking out all this. There was such a cultural explosion in the 60s, and me and most of my friends got into the Beatles and Hendrix and the psychedelic stuff and everything. And it was a real exciting time. And so I was checking all that out. But by the end of, by about 69 or 70, a lot of my friends said, "Hey, let's just play blues," because Hendrix died in 70, Cream had broken up, and to some of us, those were kind of the main bands, and some of the bands that were starting to follow some of those bands, to us, they weren't so interesting anymore, and we just wanted to play blues again. Not many people cared, but that's what we wanted to do. And so for a long time, that's what I concentrated on here, all through the 70s and in the 80s. It was mostly blues-related stuff. But I don't really take myself seriously as a blues guy. As a guitar player, listening to blues guys and jazz guys, to me, like, okay, that's the way to play guitar. That's how I hear music. That's the way I want, that's the kind of racket I want to make, the kind of racket those blues guys make and the jazz guys. But I also liked other stuff, mostly just rootsy stuff, older, old school stuff. And so these days, the kind of bands I play in, it's mostly just rootsy stuff. I play in a few different bands, and we just play all kinds of stuff. And in one sense, these bands might even be considered cover bands. But I guess they are, because that's mostly what we play is covers. But we're not the kind of cover band that you would hear at a airport hotel. It's not just a typical, I mean, nothing against them, but we don't do Journey songs or Jefferson Starship or Jimmy Buffett. We don't do that. It's all either B.B. King or whatever. It's just anything that we like. And so, and I play with my pals, and we play at different places. And I play at Antone's. Mostly we play blues at Antone's. I play at the Saxon Pub with our Saxon Pub band, and we just do everything we like. We're about the same age, and we like the Stones, and we like B.B. King, and we like just all kinds of old R&B and soul music, just whatever. As long as it's kind of, almost everything we play is like pre-1969 or something. And so these days I just play, I don't know what to call it other than rootsy stuff and an occasional almost jazz gig. I'm not really a jazz player, but I like to play at it. But I'm not a jazz player by any means. until I got here, my life was, I had a lot of obstacles in my life, and all the bands I played in before I got here were insignificant and forgettable. I mean, the one that was the most significant to me was the one I played in high school, because that was my first band, but the bands that I played in after that were forgettable and insignificant because I had all these obstacles and I couldn't take playing music seriously. But when I moved down here, still all of my obstacles weren't quite out of the way, but I was getting closer and closer to just be a musician. And so when I moved down here a month before Jimmy Vaughn and Doyle Bramhall moved down here. And within a week of them moving down here, we had a band and we were playing blues. It was called Storm. It was Jimmy's first Austin band after he lived here. It was called Storm. And I played with them for a while, and then other old school Austin people, W.C. Clark and Angela Straley and me, we put together a band called Southern Feeling. And then Paul Ray and I don't know if you know any of these names, not Paul Ray, had the radio show Twine Time. Paul Ray and I were trying to put together a band in Dallas before we moved down here, but back in the late 60s and early 70s, there were so few people that wanted to play blues or wanted to hear it that we had a lot of trouble putting together a four-piece band that was a blues-type band. But eventually Paul and I put together a band in 1974 called Paul Ray and the Cobras, and it was a real fun band, and Stevie Vaughn joined that band in 1975 and played with us two or three years, and then went on from that band to be Stevie Ray Vaughan. And then and I played with Lou Ann Barton a little bit, and then played in the Angela Straley band, and then in the early mid 80s, Antone's in its third location had moved over to the Drag over around 29th and Guadalupe, and we put together a house band. And in most of the 80s, I still played with Angela, but we had the house band, and that was a pretty important, significant band, because Antone's brought to town to his club. Clifford brought almost all the living blues legends that could travel. And so over a period of years, I was fortunate enough to be in the house band, sometimes playing guitar, sometimes playing piano. And we backed up all these great people, and which was unbelievable. I got to play with people I never thought I'd ever even hear, much less play with. And then I moved to Los Angeles in 92 and had my own band out there for a while. And then I was living there, but Jimmy Vaughn put together his first band after he made his first solo album. Jimmy Vaughn's first solo album was called Strange Pleasure. And I actually played on a few songs on that. And he, when the album came out, he went on tour, and I actually went out and played piano on that tour for about a year and a half. And then from there, in the mid-90s, I got a job playing with Taj Mahal in one of his outfits, the outfit called Taj Mahal and the Phantom Blues Band. And I did that for 6 or 7 years. And then I had to move back to Dallas to look after my dad. And right after I moved back there in early 05, I started playing with Bob Dylan. And I did that for about 5 years. And then I left that about 6, 7 years ago. And I looked after my dad for a while after that, and then I moved back down here about 5 or 6 years ago and haven't really done anything all that noteworthy since I got here, mainly just playing around town with my pals. Well, they were all like going to school, all of them really, because, I mean, I'm still trying to learn how to play guitar, and I know what kind of music I like. I like jazz and I like blues, and these days I'm trying to play steel guitar, and so now I'm interested in older classic country music and hillbilly music, and I like that. But I mean, I still I'm still learning about new blues recordings and new blues guys, and I'm still trying to play along with the records and learn stuff and watching guitar lessons on YouTube and whatever. And every band that I play in has been a little bit different. The blues band, most of the blues bands that I played with, most of them, not all, but some of them, we went slightly beyond just the normal three chord Chicago type blues. We, like, especially with Paul Red and the Cobras, we were doing some soul songs and some kind of bluesy jazz stuff and some R&B, old, not modern R&B, of course, but what we called R&B back then. It was all fun and all learning, playing in all those bands. They were all learning experiences, just maybe a slightly different emphasis. But I was learning in all of them, and I'm still learning. And I like to play. I've never really had to play in an outfit that I didn't enjoy playing with. Playing with Bob Dylan was not exactly a walk in the park, but it was an honor to play with him, but it was hard. But most of the rest of it was more fun, let's say. But I still enjoy playing, and I still enjoy learning. So I don't know. I've learned from every band I played in, and enjoy just about every band I played in, and they were all different, but they're still all in the umbrella of old school blues and blues related R&B, soul, jazz, that the blues and its first cousins. That's what I like. It's what I play. It's all I really know. I feel really fortunate to be a musician. Partly, I just don't know any better, but it's just all I know. And I have been broke most of my life. I did make some money with Bob, and I've made a little bit of money, but I don't. I was really kind of more interested in trying to be a guitar player and try to make a living playing music. And I've had some hard times, but I've still. It took me. I had so many obstacles in my life, and it took me so long to be in a place where I could just be a musician and nothing else, that just about ever since those days when I got all that other stuff out of the way, I've just been happy because I could finally try to make to just live as being a musician. And so I feel real fortunate at that, even though it's not like Miss Lavelle said one time, it haven't been easy. But that's okay, because I'm just kind of obsessed with music, and that's what my life is. And so I get, you know, that's really kind of all I know. But if I have to know something, I'm glad it's that. I just wish I knew more about it. As long as there's electricity, people are gonna have the possibility of being exposed to blues. You know, some kid's gonna hear some blues somewhere, something he had never heard because it's not in his world, and some kid's gonna go, the heck is that? I like that. Or I'm curious about that because it's not like anything I've heard. And so some people are gonna pursue that, but live blues, I don't know. I don't know. For me, I mean, there's some really good players in town right now. But most of the old guys, the guys that invented this stuff, not all of them, but most of them they're just gone. And there'll never be another Muddy Waters. There'll never be another all these guys, B.B. King, those guys just kind of wrote the book. I mean, they're different from each other, but it's, I don't know. There'll always be somebody, there'll always be somebody that wants to, if you have any interest in playing guitar, there's always going to be somebody that's going to want to play blues. But it's never, it never has been like on the chart. Well, there was a time back in the 50s and 60s where some blues guys actually, and jazz guys even, crossed over and had hit songs. There has been some crossover by authentic blues guys. When I was a kid, Jimmy Reed was on the charts, on the top 40 charts, and Muddy Waters had a song or two, John Lee Hooker had a song or two. So but it's been a long time since that happened, and it'll probably never happen again. So I don't know what the future of it is. There'll always be somebody that's going to discover it and try to carry the torch. There'll always be somebody doing that. Gary Clark Jr. could do that if he wanted to, but I think it would be silly for him to just totally concentrate on blues. I think that would be silly and not necessary. Blues is very limiting, and it can be a dead end. I mean, it served B.B. good, you know, it served him well, and a couple other people, it served them real well, but for a lot of people, blues, it's just limiting. People are bored with it. They don't even know what it is. If they hear it, they don't like it. And it doesn't have it just has not much commercial appeal or commercial possibility. So it's very limiting. And so it's never going to be in the spotlight. But and true blues, it's like, you're not supposed to use gimmicks and stuff. Blues is supposed to be sexy and, I mean, earthy. The more technology, I mean, there's nothing wrong with having an electric guitar, an amplifier, Hammond organ. There's nothing wrong with electricity and microphones and stuff. But blues is best, in my opinion, played on instruments like that. And so much of the current music, that's just almost ancient. It's almost a thing in the past. I guess there'll always be rock and roll bands with two guys up there with long hair playing a guitar too loud. You know, there'll always probably be somebody doing that. But I mean, all the Ariana and Beyonce and all, I mean, and the Jay-Z, all of Snoop, all that's where all the attention is, mainly, you know. And the studio techniques are so, technology changed so much that just recording music, that's changed everything so much. You know, you don't even hardly have to have any musical talent to put out an album anymore. You don't really have to. If you have auto-tune, even if you can't carry a tune, you can be a vocalist on a recording. Electronics and technology, that's what's happening, and you can't stop it. And it's not bad. It's just that it doesn't have anything to do with blues and the old technology. It's just kind of getting left behind. Not totally, because there'll always somebody on the radio is always gonna. I mean, I know somebody now. He's got a radio show. I mean, at least one person that plays old stuff. The listener-supported stations. They have programming where they play blues or they play old stuff, hillbilly stuff, or older jazz or something. So it's never gonna go away. And there's gonna be a few people that are gonna hear that accidentally or from whatever. But that's not where the focus is, you know, the media, that's not where the emphasis is. So I'm not sure, I don't know about the future of live blues. I don't know. We'll just have to see. But it doesn't actually trouble me that much because, in my opinion, the best blues that's ever been played, it's already been played. I mean, that may not be fair and it may not even be true, but I mean, Muddy Waters stuff, he's got a whole lot of stuff. He's got a lot of recorded output. Alan Wolfe, Jimmy Reed, Freddie King, B.B. King, John Lee Hooker, Bobby Blue Bland, T-Bone Walker, that's there. That's already there. And it's going to, that stuff's been sounding good for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, and it's going to, whoever's alive in 50 or 60 years from now, I hope that people hadn't lost their humanity enough to where they can't hear that and go, wow, what is that? You know, I like that. I mean, we'll see. Things are changing so radically that who knows what'll happen, but so I don't know. I mean, if blues just totally disappears, then that's just what happens. I know I'm going to disappear. I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't have a lot of optimism about maybe live blues going into the future, but I would be more worried about the lack of electricity, because as long as there's electricity, somebody's going to be able to hear Muddy Waters and B.B. King and John Lee Hooker. It's going to be there. So whether anybody's playing it or not, I don't know. I don't really know that Austin's influenced my playing or my career. Well, it's influenced my career, but I mean, because I already, the music that I like and the music that I'm learning from, it didn't really come from Austin. I already had, I was pretty educated about this stuff before I got here, and I still, I mean, I've learned a lot while I'm here, but like I learned a lot from just listening to the records, and I already kind of knew what I liked, so I'm not really sure how I was influenced by Austin other than the opportunity to play with some really great people and at great venues, certain bands, the Antone's House Band, and just playing with all these great players that are here. But most of them came from someplace else. They came here to play music. So I've benefited by being in Austin, but I'm not sure that my taste or anything was influenced by Austin, because I already kind of knew what I liked. Had I lived someplace or moved someplace other than Austin when I did, I mean, who knows what my life would be like. I already knew what I had decided that I wanted to play, and pretty much I was probably going to go in some blues direction, probably, but what I think what really kept me on track and actually did influence me was like Jimmy Vaughn moved here right after I did, and he came down with Doyle Bramhall, and they came down to play blues. They had already played rock and roll stuff in Dallas, but they said, "Oh, well, let's play blues." And then Stevie came down about a year after that and was all about blues, and my pal Paul Ray, he came down, and all of us just kind of wanted to play blues. And so I got the kind of reinforcement by people that I respected, that I might not have had that kind of reinforcement in other places. I'm not sure where I would have. I might have just ended up playing with who was there or something. But Jimmy and Doyle and all of there was just several of us from Dallas that kind of moved down the same time. And I mean, we didn't invent blues, and there was people playing blues before we got here. But my posse was the Dallas guys, and we came down to play blues. We had similar tastes. And that kind of probably kept me on track. And I there was other spots in the country where similar things were happening. I didn't know it at the time, but up in Providence, Rhode Island, they kind of had a similar kind of movement up there, contemporary with ours. And on the West Coast, they also did too, but I wasn't aware of that. So if I'd have moved to Providence, Rhode Island, which I didn't know anything about and wasn't going to happen, maybe I would have been a similar player. Or had I moved to the West Coast, there were people out there, maybe so, but for the most part in the late 60s and early 70s, it was difficult to find people that even wanted to play blues. So, but coming to Austin, I had a little family all right there with me, you know, and so it kept us all on track. They weren't of Austin, but we came to Austin and reinforced each other. So in that sense, Austin did shape what I did. Venues I played a long time ago, when I first got here, It's like I didn't have anything lined up when I came. I just came because I liked the place, and there really wasn't much of a music scene. I mean, there was music here before we got here, but Austin wasn't known as a music town so much. But a lot of people discovered Austin about the time I did because everybody was hitchhiking all over the place, and the word got out that Austin was one of the oases in the country where freaks could kind of go and feel kind of halfway safe or something. So there was already stuff going on here, but it wasn't known. But there was a really great place before I got here called the Vulcan Gas Company and some other places too. And I actually played with Jimmy and Paul Ray at the Vulcan Gas Company. It was right down on Congress, and it was a really great venue. Muddy Waters played. It was kind of a hippie psychedelic club, but Muddy Waters played there with Otis Spann and the band, and Mance Lipscomb used to play there. Johnny Winter recorded, I guess, his first album there, and it has its own historic things, although at the time it was just Austin's local hippie rock and roll psychedelic joint. And then I moved down here right after that closed, although I was lucky enough to play at it a couple of times, even before I moved here. By the time I moved here, it had already closed. But right after I moved here, the Armadillo in 1970, right after I moved here, the Armadillo World Headquarters opened up. And we started hanging out down there, and it was crazy because when I moved here, nobody knew who I was. I hadn't done anything of note. And Jimmy Vaughn was 7 years younger than me, but he already kind of had a name regionally. He already kind of had a name. So when we started playing, as soon as we all got here, I thought, well, we're going to rule this town pretty quick, really. But nobody really cared, and we had trouble getting gigs. I was going, but we had trouble getting gigs, except Eddie Wilson would hire us to play at the best venue in town. So we played at we couldn't hardly get a gig at just some crappy joint or just some beer joint rock and roll club, but Eddie Wilson would hire us to play the best, most important venue in town. So I'll always be grateful to Eddie Wilson for allowing us to play at the Armadillo World Headquarters. And there was a lot of other clubs from the early days that I don't really remember quite so much. And I mean, Soap Creek finally opened up in maybe 74, something like that, 73, 74. Soap Creek Saloon was an important place to play. And I've forgotten about a lot of them. There were so many that came and went because I lived here all in the 70s and 80s, and a lot of clubs come and go in that time. There was a really great place in the 80s called Clubfoot. It's right downtown, right downtown on 3rd or 4th Street, right off Congress. And it was a great kind of, it was almost more like a new wave club, but it was really great because a band I was in, the Cobras, after Stevie left, we backed up Bo Diddley there. We opened up for James Brown. B.B. King played there, but also the Romantics played there, and Robert Gordon played there, and all these new wave and punk bands also played there. So there was a time when there just weren't very many blues bars. And so the people playing blues had to play venues where other kinds of music was played, which was actually good. I liked that. But Clubfoot was a great venue like that for all kinds of music. The Armadillo was great. Everybody from Frank Zappa to some serious jazz guys to Taj Mahal and ZZ Top and Bruce Springsteen, The Police, just everybody. I mean, the Rolling Stones were too big to play there, but the Armadillo World Headquarters was open for 10 years, and the people that played there, it had a remarkable history. And of course, Antone's. So there were some really important, Soap Creek was important, Antone's was open, it was important. I'd say Clubfoot was important. There was a lot of important venues, and then many others the Continental Club, where I still play at Antone's. Antone's is in its, I guess, fifth or sixth location. It opened up in 1975, and it's still surviving. And the Continental Club's been around forever, a great place. And a place called Seaboys is here now, and the Saxon Pub's been here for a while. So these days I mainly play Antone's, the Saxon Pub, Seaboys, the Continental Club, and this crazy little hillbilly biker, hillbilly crazy little place out way out Manchac called Giddy Ups. They let me play my steel guitar out there, so that's fun. But and then every once in a while some miscellaneous gig will pop up. But a lot of the places that I used to play, of course, I mean, I moved here 70 years ago. That was a long time ago. And so most of the places that we used to play are closed. But there were some really good ones and some important ones. And the Continental Club's still here. Antone's is still here. Saxon's been there 20 years or so. The Elephant Room's been there a really long time. I played there several times. So there's actually the Spoke. I've never played the Broken Spoke, but that's an important venue that's been here a really long time, longer than me. And that's a straight ahead country place, which I don't really deserve to play. That's not really what I do, but it's a great fun place to go. So Austin has and then there were places, the New Orleans Club and the Jade Room that were open before I got here, and other places that were here before I got here. So Austin's got the Skyline Club at far north Austin, that where Soap Creek moved into. The Skyline Club, I think, is where I think it might be where Hank Williams played his last gig. Is that right? I think Hank Williams played his last gig at this place called Far North Austin. I think it was his last show. I think Elvis played there maybe back in his early days. I've just been real fortunate to play with a lot of people. Living here, I got exposure to, I got the opportunity to play with people I never dreamed I would play with. And I'd be totally grateful for that. And and a lot of them turned out to be my friends. Like Stevie and Jimmy are my pals. I still miss Stevie all the time. He was Stevie's 10 years younger than me, but I didn't know Jimmy and me and Stevie, Doyle Bramhall, Paul Ray. We're all from Dallas, but I knew Paul Ray in Dallas. I'd met Jimmy, played a couple of gigs with him, but I didn't know Doyle Bramhall, and I didn't know Stevie in Dallas. I didn't know them till we all moved down here, but we all got to be great friends and did some great things together. And of course, Stevie went off to become Stevie Ray Vaughan and that whole story. But to us, he was just Stevie, the kid that was always, where's Stevie? Where is he now? Or, you know, somebody go get him or something. You know, so Stevie was just the kid that was frustrating to us sometimes, but it was, you couldn't get mad at Stevie. You could get frustrated because he was the kid, you know, and always late or needed to borrow a guitar or $5 or a ride or something. But it was hard to, but he was a lot of fun. He's a really sweet, sweet person. I miss him. It's amusing to me on a few different levels. Like I say, I knew Stevie. We had been roommates a couple of different times and played in that band, Paul Ray and the Cobras, and had a lot of musical experiences together. And we used to hang out and listen to records and turn each other, hey, check this out. Yeah, will you check this out and all that stuff. So we all learned a lot from each other just hanging out. Back then we were younger and we just had time to hang out and listen to music and go eat breakfast tacos and stuff, and it was great. And then of course Stevie and Jimmy both were people that we knew before they were famous, but they were the kind of people that, to those of us that knew them and to people around town, it was pretty obvious that Jimmy and Stevie were, everybody else is going to hear from them later on. I mean, at some point, they're going to And so we all knew that Stevie was gonna something. We didn't know what, but something. We knew that people were gonna hear from Stevie, and so he left our band to go start being Stevie Ray Vaughan, and we're going, go Stevie, it's time for you to do that now, because up until then he had just mainly been the other guitar player in other bands, you know. And he, when I played with him in Paul Ray and the Cobras, he was just the other guitar player. He sang a few songs, but he was just the guitar player. And in another band he was in, the Nightcrawlers, he was just the guitar player in the band. And Blackbird, he was just the guitar player. But anyway, so eventually Stevie goes off, and he's just got this thing that a lot of people can relate to. And of course he was doing really well, and then he died in that crash, and probably, I guess, at the peak of his, I think his career and his personal life, everything in his life was probably better than it was all probably just the best that had ever been in his life, I think, probably. And then he's just out like a light just then. And so all of these, it was, that happened in 1990, and a couple of years later I moved to Los Angeles, and even two or three or four years later, when people found out that I knew him, just because if you do enough research on Stevie and he's your idol, you're going to come across my name eventually, if you're just a real Stevie nut. And anyway, people just made a point of, especially, and then when I moved to Los Angeles and people found out I was from Austin, oh, well, you play blues, you're from Austin, you're Stevie, whatever. So all these people were, that never met him, some of them never even heard him play, were so touched by, they would tell me how somehow he helped them get sober and everything, and it was real touching and everything. And then there were so many people just the way they talked about him and the way they thought about him and who Stevie was to them, it was like he was just this, because he died like he died, it almost made him an instant deity, kind of. I mean, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan, I mean, everybody knows who he is, and the tragic story, but now Stevie's almost a deity, and all these people would talk to me about him, and I was real touched by their, how much they really loved him, and all these guitars for several years after he died, you couldn't swing a cat without hitting some guy that wanted to play guitar like him, you know. And I got kind of tired of hearing it, but you gotta, whatever, everybody has their own influence, but anyway, so to a lot of people, Stevie was this deity, whether it was as a guitar god or as somebody that was an inspiration to them in their recovery or whatever. But I mean, to me, he was just my pal. I just missed him, you know. And but it's funny to think that. I hope somebody wouldn't get offended by this, but like, an example of, I've told the story before, but a Stevie story would be, and I think really all of this happened in one day. It might have happened in two different days, but I think all of this actually happened in one day. It's like, it's just a memory of Stevie, the way he was when we knew him. So we were in Paul Ray and the Cobras, and we were over at the drummer's house because we had to drive to Lubbock and to play a few gigs up there. And so everybody gets over to to the drummer's house, to Rodney's house, and just go, well, where's Stevie? Well, he's late again. Well, okay, somebody call him. Well, his phone's been cut off. Well, he don't have a car, so somebody go by his house. So I go, okay, I'll go by his house. So I drive by his house, knock on the door. A couple of minutes later, he comes to the door. Oh, yeah, okay, I'll be right with you. I'm going to take a real quick shower, and I'll be right out. And we're already been waiting on him to show up and everything. So, okay, Stevie, take your shower. So he finally comes out, and he comes out with his girlfriend. He says, well, hey, Lindy's got to go to work. Can we run her over to North Austin and take her home so she can go to work? Yeah, okay, Stevie, we'll run Lindy home. And so we take Lindy home, and we're coming back so we can go to Lubbock. And he says, y'all eating? And we say, yeah, Stevie, we ate 2 or 3 hours ago now, you know. And, oh, well, could we pull into Dan's? I'll get it to go. Yeah, okay, Stevie, sure. We'll pull into Dan's, get you a burger. He said, well, could I borrow $5 from somebody? You know, and it just kept going like this. And said, oh, you're sure, Stevie, here's $5. Okay. Does anybody need to go to Ray's? Meaning Ray Hennig's Heart of Texas Music. No, we already been to, we went to the music store yesterday, Stevie. Well, I need to go borrow an amp. And so, okay, well, we'll run you to Ray's, you know. And then we, I mean, it just, that was the Stevie that I knew. But that was the Stevie, the human being, that I, you still didn't get mad at him. I mean, he was maybe 21 by now or something, you know, and he just kind of couldn't help it, you know. But he was a great guitar player already. He's a really good guitar player, but he was the youngest one, and he was just a kid, you know, and could be really, it's just funny to think of him as this kid that needs to borrow $5 for a burger, you know, and a ride here and a ride there, and his phone's cut off, and all this kind of stuff. But that's the Stevie that we knew and the Stevie that we loved, and that's the Stevie that I miss, you know. So it's just the way it is sometimes.